And tonight we go In the Center of the Fire, a memoir of the occult from 66 to 89. James Wasserman with us. Let's get right into it in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. James Wasserman, a lifelong student of religion, spiritual development, writings, editorial efforts, maintain a focus on creative mythology, secret society, spirituality, history, religion. He's very passionate about individual liberty as well, an admirer of teachings of Aleister Crowley. He has also played a key role in numerous publications of the Crowley Library. Here he is on Coast to Coast, James Wasserman back. James, how are you?
Oh, George, I'm just fine. Thank you so much for having me back on the show.
It's perfect timing, Halloween, kind of mystical, but this is much more than that. What have you been doing lately? You wrote a memoir now, huh?
Yeah, I sure did. A little different than the last one we discussed, the Temple of Solomon. This that one took 5 years of constant and steady effort. This one was done in about a year from the time I started. It flowed out of me faster than I can imagine. It was just like a long-held passion that needed to be released. And boy, oh boy, it's gotten some pretty great reception from a lot of people who have been very touched by it.
You looked at the period 1966 through 1989. How did you select that era?
Well, 1966 is the year I left home. You know, I started the book at 18 years old. It's not an autobiography. What it is a memoir of a period of time, a period of history. And I started it in 1966 because I wanted to give a sense of who I was before some of the really important events that I needed to describe occurred. And I ended it in 1989 with the death of my best friend, who had succeeded me as the lodge master of Tahuti Lodge, and who was one of the most profoundly developed adepts of the path of Thelema and the magic of Aleister Crowley. And, you know, he passed away. I stopped taking drugs, and you know, it was like really the end of a certain period of my life. And I would never have gone that far. I wanted to stop the book in 1985, when my initiator and teacher died, and the lawsuit and that I describe at some length in the book regarding copyrights had been resolved in our favor, Grady McMurtry's successor, Caleb Hymenaeus Beta, was elected, and I was part of the election. And, you know, I would have really ended it there because that would have been an easy place for me to do it. But other people asked me to go further and describe Gurney's leadership of the lodge, and unfortunately that also resulted in or had to describe some real serious trouble I had with drugs, and of which Gurney died.
Well, this was a tumultuous time then for you.
Yeah, this was a real painful time. And I'm glad that I told it. It's almost like an exorcism, you know, it sort of takes it away. It also adds an element, I think, of honesty to the book that, you know, had I not gone that far, it would have been a little more self-serving. I mean, I tell a lot of fun stories in there, and a lot of good things were going on, but this last few years was a rough period, and the fact that it's in there, I think, adds some depth to it, because people, there seems to be a relationship between drugs and magic that certainly goes back to Crowley, at least, if not to the illusion mysteries. I mean, it's a long-term thing, and somehow I discuss it and describe it, and I think I open up to people the idea that maybe it's not necessary to abuse drugs the way so many of us did.
Well, that's a good point. Let's talk with you about Crowley for a moment. Who was he?
Well, you know, he was an Englishman who was born in 1875. He was upper class. His father was a preacher. What we would call today a religious fundamentalist of a very small sect. And, you know, he died when Crowley was quite young. a boy, and Crowley was then raised by his mother, that with whom he had a real antipathy, and an uncle who was apparently very cruel to him. And, you know, he suffered a great deal from fundamentalism and narrow-minded lifestyle. He went to Cambridge, and his life just opened up. He was exposed to literature. Previously, he had only been allowed to read the Bible. He was exposed to literature. He was exposed to the bohemian lifestyle, which was going on all around him. And on a trip to the continent, he became exposed to mysticism and alchemy, and a proponent of shame who introduced him to some people. And before he knew it, he joined a group called the Golden Dawn, the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, in London. And he rose rapidly through the grades of the order and was involved in a bunch of controversy with that group. And in 1904, while traveling throughout the world, he received a book by direct voice transmission.
From whom?
From a force who identified himself as Iwas, a representative of the spiritual hierarchy that was guiding humanity through what Crowley called the next stage of our development, the new eon. It began in 1904, and it presumably extends for 2,000 years. It replaces Christianity, and it's called the eon of the child, or the time when humanity is taking on the archetype of you know, the growing, expanding, kind of free but a little bit whiny, perhaps, identification with the child. We had gone through the identity of the mother, the period where that archetype was predominant in the goddess religions of antiquity. You know, we then passed through, you know, the period of the father, where there was self-sacrifice and strict, superstitious, fearful religiosity, which was, you know, the kind of Christian Jewish era.
And, was he a good guy, or was he an evil guy, James?
Aleister Crowley?
Yeah.
Oh, he was the savior in just so many ways. I mean, he was a wonderful guy. He had a great sense of humor. He was just funny as can be. Part of the problem is that, you know, he was a jokester and a trickster, and he got us, his, you know, his followers, successors, into kind of a world of trouble by just saying a whole bunch of funny things, which were designed to shock. And believe me,
off
they
the wall
shock.
Stuff. Okay.
You know, it's like we're like kind of walking around going, oh my goodness, now what do we do with this statement that he made?
Yeah.
You know, but he
plots
he
it on you,
master.
You got to figure it out.
Pardon
well,
me?
was he a black magician?
Not at all. Again, that was part of his persona. It was part of the joke that he was telling, but he was absolutely a master of the light. He sought for something that he described as the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel. He spoke about that at length. He described it as the next step for humanity. And, you know, what it is, quite frankly, is union with God. He spoke about a state called crossing of the abyss, which is almost the self-becoming God, the apotheosis, the loss of all personal attachment. And, in fact, those who fail in that ordeal become the black magicians, black brothers of which he is accused. And he was far from that. He was a great seeker, a great teacher, and a wonderful person. You know, as far as I can tell, I mean, he had his character flaws. We all do. But
We're human.
He was luminary.
But I would guess at that time period, people really thought he might have been an evil man. So you're saying that's not true. It was more myth. But did he kind of feel it? I mean, you talked about his practical joking, but did it bother him that people thought he was so dark?
Well, it certainly bothered him. He did get involved in some lawsuits around it. But again, part of it was his own doing. I mean, he was involved with a very bohemian circle, really avant-garde people, Aubrey Beardsley and, a whole crowd of, English decadents and then European artists. He was, close to Renoir and other people Rodin. And other people who were, frequenting the Paris bohemian scene. He traveled throughout the world. But, he did things. Like he talked about, sacrificing goats in Indian temples where he would dress like a native. And he, was a proponent of drug use, which got him in a lot of trouble. He claimed at times to be a black magician. As a spoof, and he was libeled as the world's most evil man. He was a trickster and a jokester. He was also a sexually open person. He was bisexual. He had a multitude of partners and spoke about a kind of free love that later became part of the hippie culture. He was a man ahead of his time, and he loved shock value.
Interesting person indeed. How long did he live, James?
From 1875 to 1947. So, he was hardly, he was hardly a sick man. In fact, at the age of 72, he passed away from complications of asthma. Which had plagued him his whole life, and partly responsible for his heroin addiction, which had been prescribed to him as an asthma controlling medication by doctors of the time. He was. I knew a fellow who knew him personally and who just spoke so highly of him. He was a young American soldier named Grady McMurtry, and he met Crowley toward the end of his life. But he spoke of him as a very tender, gentle man who had a wonderful sense of humor, avid chess player, apparently really, really skilled. He could play two games at once, blindfolded. He was a remarkable individual and a writer. My goodness, he wrote literally a bookcase full of books.
Let me ask you then, through this period that you were looking at the occult, most people thought the occult, James, still do, deals and dabbles with this black magic, with sorcery, with Satanism, totally out of context?
Well, there are Satanists and there are black magicians, but occultism is not that. Occultism is a philosophy or a practice in which people assert their ability and freedom to become one with God, in fact, to become gods ourselves. We tend to believe that the human being contains the divine seed and that we have a right to the knowledge and the fullness of the divine experience in our own lives. We are not waiting for heaven. We're not afraid of hell. We're experiencing both in the physical body, and we're attempting to achieve the coursing of that energy through the body itself and in the psyche. So no, it is not black magic. There are black magicians. I'm not one.
No, I know that. You definitely aren't. Well, as you moved along into other areas that you investigated, tell me a little bit about your focus on what you call the OTO.
Well, the OTO was a group that Crowley kind of inherited the leadership of, and he began the English-speaking order in 1912. So we've just actually celebrated our centennial this year. And the OTO is a group started in the 1890s. It was started by high-level Freemasons in Germany, and what differentiated it from Masonic groups is that it accepted women. And they had some sexual yoga teachings that had been imported into the group from a variety of Indian sources and also, you know, European and American adepts as well. And so they taught a kind of, you know, broadly varied Masonic style teaching with a lot of yoga. And what Crowley did was he interjected this Book of the Law teaching, the Law of Thelema, the Law of Do What Thou Will. And he took the rituals of the OTO and modified them to bring them in line with the teachings of the Book of the Law. And eventually, around 1922, he became the world head of the OTO and held that position until he died. And his chief disciple at the time of his death was a man named Carl Germer, and he took over the leadership of OTO. And when Grady McMurtry met Crowley through the 40s, Crowley gave him some papers that essentially authorized him to take over the work of the order after Germer died. Germer was quite old at the time, and Crowley was looking ahead to a successor, to his own successor. And he gave Grady some documentation toward that end. And Grady activated that in 1969 after Germer died, and there had been a robbery, and there was a period of great chaos in the OTO. And that, a lot of that is what I describe in the book. And I met Grady and took initiation into the OTO in 1976. And I've been a member ever since and remained quite active.
I remember in my youth, I liked reading these different unusual books. And there was a publisher, Samuel Weiser, and he came out with all kinds of books. Were you familiar with that?
Very much so, George. I worked at Weiser's for 4 years.
You're kidding. Was it a bookstore or a publisher?
Well, it was both. It was both. I started out in the bookstore around 1972, 73. And I stayed there until 1977. And as a result of my time there, that's ultimately how I met Grady McMurtry and another fellow, a Brazilian adept named Marcelo Moda, who represented AA, which is another part of the Crowley legacy in terms of a teaching order, a spiritual order. AA is much more related to individual work and individual practice of meditation and yoga and magic and psychological exercises that develop the person as a coherent psychic entity. And it's a very personal type of group. It focuses on a teacher and after a time, you know, people acquire students, but there's no social interaction. But in any case, Moda had...
Hold on for a second, James. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about this when we roll back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, as you know, every Wednesday, a Coast to Coast listener has an opportunity to sound off. They send in, of course, what they want to sound off about to editorial@coasttocoastam.com. We go through it and call you back. And you can do that. Make sure you put in what you want to sound off about and your phone number. Here's one of our Coast to Coast listeners.
When our bodies and minds fail, we place our faith in the hands of the medical profession, hoping that salvation is only one pill or procedure away. What we must realize is true healing requires self-empowerment, not just the removal or obscuring of symptoms. You cannot go to your doctor confessing your sins of lifestyle and hope for lasting absolution through pills any more than a priest with prayers. Change must come from within. The path to physical, mental, and spiritual wellness lies in your choices and actions, one day at a time, creating a better future through will, perseverance. This is Brandon East Troy, Wisconsin, and this has been my Sound Off.
And welcome back to Coast, James Wasserman. With us, James, we were talking about the Samuel Weiser bookstore. Who was Samuel Weiser, by the way?
Well, you know, George, Samuel Weiser was a Jewish bookstore owner, and he started the store in the 1920s. And there's a wonderful tale, and I'm not quite sure how true it is, but it's kind of neat in its own way, that a customer who is called Mr. Zero, a member of the Baha'i faith, came in and asked for occult books, and Samuel Weiser didn't know anything about it. And basically, he began to get books, and then this Mr. Zero brought friends by, and before you know it, Weiser had about half the bookstore devoted to occult books, and it was located at that time on 14th Street in Union Square. And then they moved to Waverly Place in Broadway, and Samuel's son Donald took over, and then it became a, you know, fully occult bookstore with a lot of books on Eastern and Western mysticism, both. It was a real true crossroads of the world. People, occultists from every part of the world came by to visit there. You know, New York is the center of the earth, basically, as it is. And so people from California and Hawaii and France, and we had a customer from Japan and China, remember, quite a few, shipping books all throughout the world, India. And we also distributed books for various small publishers in various parts of the world. So Weiser's was a real cultural center. And Donald Weiser is very much alive today and remains a great friend of mine. And in fact, he is the publisher of this memoir. I worked for him. I was unfamiliar with publishing. I had no real background, but I started out in the bookstore and just kept going, and circumstances opened up that kind of, you know, catapulted me higher and higher in the organization. But, you know, I met so many wonderful people coming through those doors. It was wild. I mentioned in the book that they had a Christmas party every year, and they would have food and drink, and people would gather around and talk, and just, you know, everyone was so interested in what each other was thinking, and readers would kind of come into the store, and maybe they hadn't seen each other for a year, and they, you know, these parties were just wonderful, really, really excellent opportunities for occultists to share different experiences from their own lives and practices. And, you know,
well, if my memory serves me, James, I think also I ordered some books when I was younger from Weiser, and I think he just like mails them out to you, right?
Absolutely. There was a large mail order business, and that was originally where I started, was the mail order department. So sure, he had a catalog. And where were you located at the time, George?
I was in Detroit, Michigan, when I would have been ordering.
Okay, well, sure. There were plenty of people throughout the world that were buying books by mail, and there was a nice catalog. And eventually, he got into publishing. They started the publishing, I think, in the 1950s, and they were doing these little pamphlets that were, reprints of some of the Golden Dawn material. And then over time, they began to do more and more publishing, and they started to really do a bunch of Crowley. And that began around 1969, was their real plunge into the Crowley publishing. And when I came in, I spent 6 months in the bookstore and moved into the publishing department. So that's how I met a lot of the people I describe in the book, and also how I got involved in, you know, some of the legal issues that, you know, haunted me for a number of years. But, yeah, it was a wonderland, just a wonderland. People would write in there all the time and, you know, ask these kinds of questions about their spiritual paths, you know, based on the books we published. It was just a wild place.
What's your definition, James, of the occult?
My definition of the occult is essentially knowing. I mean, the word occult means hidden, and I think I think of occult practices as Gnosticism, and Gnosticism means knowing. And the occult is a kind of, it's a hidden truth about oneself that, you know, you can plumb the depths of it, but you're only going to be able to do it within yourself. Occultism is not something you can be led to by a priest or someone who's going to teach you a doctrine. Occultism is not really a doctrine. Occultism is a process of self-knowledge, self-knowing, and it can only be accomplished by the individual. And of course, you know, there are teachers and guides and people who know a little more and know techniques and have, you know, embodied some of the truths that they've found in their own lives. But I think it's called occultism because it is secret. It's internal. You know, it's almost like it's a form of meditation. It's a form of magic. It's a form of martial arts. You're really battling the demons of ignorance. And I think occultism has a bad name because it's secret. You know, it talks about it's not sharing its knowledge, so to speak, with others, except through books. I mean, but you're not openly proclaiming something. So I think occultism is hidden. It's hidden within the wellspring of the self. It's how do you reach the Godhead that is hidden within you? Where does it reside? What can you do to bring it out? What can you do to get closer to it? How can you reveal that which is hidden, that which is secret within yourself?
Do you find that a lot of people are interested in the occult today, James?
I do. I really do, and I'm happy to see it. I think that the 60s, which I describe at some length in the book, are a big part of the modern period. And you know, people like Timothy Leary and, you know, Ram Dass and the Beat Generation, the Allen Ginsbergs and William Burroughs and all those people brought this kind of, you know, hidden knowledge out into the open. They brought about a kind of exploration of the self. You know, what did it mean to be a human being? World War II, you know, brought a real sense of conformity in America, and you know, these early beatniks were kind of on the outskirts of society, the kind of dissatisfied. They weren't willing to accept the doctrinaire conservatism or period that was going on, and they opened the way for people like Leary, who all of a sudden, you know, took LSD and, you know, went from being some Harvard psychologist to being some kind of guru and, you know, a bit of a lunatic, but an evangelist who opened up a lot of kids who had been raised within a kind of conformist, almost straitjacket. You know, I remember very well the fact that everything, you know, father really did know best back in the day. And Leary was proclaiming something like, you know best, and, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out, you know, and a lot of us did. And, you know, when you did those kinds of things, what happened is it opened up a whole new realm, you know, a whole new realm of question. and a hidden realm, the realm of the occult, because all of a sudden you felt an interaction with forces that you didn't really know existed. I mean, I always had a real sense of God as a kid. I was very aware of the presence of something more than myself, but it wasn't until I started studying and practicing occultism and, you know, taking LSD and stuff like that, that it became the primary driving force of my life. And, you know, books were being published left hand over fist at Weiser's, other places, Llewellyn Publishing, Manly Hall's work was coming out all over the place, Philosophical Research Society, and, you know, this kind of combination of cultural awareness and drugs and this expansion of consciousness and, you know, the Beatles coming in with their Indian gurus and all kinds of people talking about self-knowledge. It really brought about a generational shift, a cultural shift in America and Europe, certainly. And, you know, I think it's resulted in a lot more attention to alternate religion, because in line with my belief that the Book of the Law changed consciousness in humanity as a whole, it opened up the realization that you cannot follow old-fashioned teaching.
Let me ask you this, though, James. Those who practice the occult, those who are very religious or spiritual, may think there's something wrong with that. Is there a conflict between the occult and religion?
I don't think so at all. I think that occultism essentially looks for the truth within religion. I think the conflict may be that religion talks about following doctrine and following people who are recognized as, you know, the doctrinal guide, the priest, the minister, the pope, you know, with that sense of infallibility. In occultism, we don't do that. You know, we say to people, think for yourself, explore these areas for yourself, do these practices. You know, sit down, stop thinking, shut up, and get out. That's how Crowley described yoga. Find God within yourself. I'm very much personally a, you know, major league monotheist. I believe that there is one God. I worship one God, and, you know, I have a sense that that God takes on many faces, and I love to play with all of the different aspects of that one God. And, you know, so I could be called a pagan, someone who worships many gods, you know, but whether I am or not, I don't know. You know, what I do know is that God manifests him or her or itself in so many different ways. There's a multiplicity of experience. And I'm taught to think for myself. And insofar as I teach, you know, I teach other people to think for themselves. And you know, we're asked to make our own decisions, to do our own explanations, come to our own conclusions, and build our own living faith. That sometimes conflicts with religiosity, but I don't think it does not conflict whatsoever with spirituality. And I think that true religious people are spiritual, so there is no conflict.
You had mentioned earlier that you are founder of the Tehuti Lodge. What is that?
Well, Tehuti Lodge is a gathering of people in New York City who are OTO members. It initiates OTO people into the wider order. It provides a contact point for social interaction. It's a place where we do rituals and where we perform a central ritual called the Gnostic Mass, that Crowley described as the central ritual, public and private, of the OTO. It's a gathering of people. It's a place where younger people come to learn, where older people, you know, are available to consult with. And it's one of a number of different lodges in the OTO. Tahuti is the oldest and fully functioning lodge. It's had, seven transfers of leadership since I founded it in 1979. It's doing a Gnostic Mass every week. It does countless initiations and lecture series and individual rituals, and puts out a publication several times a year. It's a place where people can come from, Europe or Asia and be initiated if they don't have functioning bodies within their own countries. Although nowadays the OTO is established in over 50 countries, and Tahuti is one of I think there's a dozen lodges in the U.S. And
It's not a lot.
Yeah.
You spend a great deal of time talking about the drugs in your book, and you mentioned it earlier on. Are we talking about mood altering, mind altering drugs?
Yeah, that's how it started. I started smoking pot, and then I, took LSD, and I opened myself up to a alternate form of consciousness through those drugs.
Dangerous?
Pardon me?
Dangerous for you then?
It was very dangerous to your sanity. I mean, people were jumping out of windows, dashing into traffic, committing suicide. I mean, there were all kinds of side effects. But one of the things that the drugs did was to open up alternate states of consciousness, which, if you could avoid getting kind of hooked on the habit-forming aspect of the drug, could be a real good experience. Crowley talked about it at great length as opening the doors of perception. In fact, he's credited with having turned Aldous Huxley onto mescaline. But what happened to me, and not unlike many people, is that I, began to get a little bit over-involved in drugs, including, including some pretty dangerous stuff like heroin stuff. Yeah.
Could have gone the wrong way there, James.
Yeah, I did go the wrong way, George. And, for the last 23 years, I've been, avoiding all of that altogether, and saved my life as a result, and opened up a whole new aspect of my religious and spiritual practices, and as well as my creativity as a writer. So it's been a very positive change for me.
Where do we get the book, In the Center of the Fire?
Well, you can get it on jameswassermanbooks.com, signed copies, and you can certainly get copies on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's over the place. You can go to your local bookstore and ask for it, order it. I've had some good feedback from it.
All right, good for you. We're going to come back in a moment, James. We're going to take phone calls. Final hour with you here on Coast to Coast AM. Phone calls about the occult. You're next on Coast to Coast AM.